Thank you, Earl. Just occurred to me, Earl said something about it's hard to find people that you can trust. And everything in the world seems to be moving. And I told a story one time that this really happened to me. I was looking in the phone book for a church name, a church number. And as I was looking in the yellow pages, I happened to look down through the church names. And, of course, there's hundreds of them. But there were two right together that caught my eye. No fancy advertisement, just two names and the number. And they were in alphabetical order, so they were right together and kind of separated from the rest. The one was called the Church on the Move. And the one right after it, right underneath it, was called the Church on the Rock. And I always thought that was interesting because I thought to myself, which of those two churches would I attend? And I figured it didn't make any difference because if I went to the Church on the Move, sooner or later we'd end up at the Church on the Rock. And if I went to the Church on the Rock, sooner or later the Church on the Move would arrive. It didn't make any difference. But that's the way it is. You can know people for years. I've known Earl for 25 years, for Larry, half that time at least. And they're the same after all those years. That's very rare today. It shows something of the grace of God. And Earl is my close friend. I'll say that. And Larry, too. Let me begin this evening with what is usually called an apology for this study. A couple things I need to say. This is the time that's usually reserved for throat clearing. You know, here's what is going to happen. This was, as Larry suggested, a series of lectures which I delivered in 1988. I looked back and found that the meager notes that I had from all those years ago was 1988. Now, this is 2008, so that means that this is 20 years old. I was addressing a group of men at Heritage Baptist Church in Shreveport, and delivering to them a lecture Earl had asked me to do. And I said, you know, sometimes people ask pastors, how long does it take you to prepare a sermon? That depends on a lot of different factors. But there's a sense in which I've been preparing this for 20 years. So if it's not good, that's really sad, isn't it? Somehow, Larry remembered those lectures which I delivered. He remembered them, but I didn't. And I do remember why I initially addressed the subject of the intercession of Christ. It's because I preached a series of messages, partly for our congregation and partly for my own benefit, which attempted to look into all of the technical words of the gospel, the ones that end in I-O-N or T-I-O-N, so propitiation, redemption, reconciliation, under redemption accomplished, then under redemption applied, of course, regeneration, justification, sanctification, glorification, all of those technical words, and one of them was intercession. And so I dealt with it there, and that's why it occurred on the list of things that I've done. Because all this stuff is so old, a good friend of mine and Earl's on the West Coast, I was crying on his shoulder about it, and he says, well, don't be too upset. It's archaeological preaching. So what I've had to do is dig back down through the strata 20 years, find the fossils of this old study, and then try to resurrect it and revive it and give it some kind of life so that I can deliver it to you here on these 2 days. I heard a story last year, Jeff Thomas, I've never forgotten it, and on the two occasions since then that I've preached in a conference setting like this, it always occurs to me, he said, told the story of a conference preacher who was called to deliver a series of lectures to a group of people. And after his first sermon, he noticed that a man from the congregation was approaching him with a revolver, and he was loading the revolver. Of course, this caused him some pause. And as the man got up to him, he said, sir, Are all those bullets for me? He says, no, none of them are for you. They're for the committee that invited you. So, now we are confronting, I think, four problems as we begin to study this subject. One of them is the deliverer of these lectures. And that would be me. And that's a problem that I feel very poignantly. James Stalker once said, I always seem to myself to be only beginning to learn my trade. And the farthest I ever get in the way of confidence is to believe that I shall preach well next time. And I know what he meant when he said that. I have no confidence in myself as to how this is going to go. It may go well, it may go poorly. We may have to struggle through this material, or we may have freedom and rejoice. We ought to rejoice at least in the truth. But that's the first problem that we face. The second problem is the lectures to be delivered. The subject of the intercessory work of Christ, as I'll point out in a few moments, is not particularly an easy one for a number of different reasons. But in studying it again and coming to appreciate the subject as much as I have, I find that it will be impossible for us to do it justice. So we're failing as we begin. So if we fail, we knew it from the very outset. There's almost an impossibility built into doing this subject its full weight and justice. The third problem is, again, a problem for me, and that is compressing these lectures into three studies or into 3 hours. And the fourth is like it. It's dividing these lectures into three parts. So if it seems as though we haven't quite come to an end, but we quit, and when we begin again, it's kind of in the middle of a sentence almost. You'll appreciate trying to divide this all into three parts. It's somewhat difficult. It doesn't divide itself neatly into three separate categories, at least not in the way that I have arranged it. All right, let's begin. The subject is the intercessory work of Christ. I think I can say, even though I know that you sit under good preaching, that you probably haven't studied this very thoroughly. And there's a couple of reasons why. The first is I'd like to have you note that there is a paucity of attention given to this subject in almost every direction that we look. It's not as if you can go into your library and find a number of volumes entitled The Intercessory Work of Christ. In fact, I don't have one with that title, nor do I know of one with that title. If there is one, I'm not familiar with it, and I have not been able to read it. So let me say four things by way of the fact that this subject has not been largely treated. It's a book that yet needs to be written. First of all, it's poorly represented in print. I have a bibliography that I made for my own satisfaction of everything that I found, everyone that has dealt with, whether they be Puritans, systematic theologies, works of various kinds. I made a list, and it's not a very long one. This is a subject which has been poorly represented in print. It's usually not a separate entry or a chapter by itself in any book that even mentions it. It's usually lost as a subheading or a footnote under Christ's office as priest. And as they deal with the offices of Christ, prophet, priest, and king, eventually they come to deal with his priestly office, and sometimes no more than a footnote, they mention, oh, by the way, part of him being a priest is that he intercedes. And that's about all it gets. I was in Earl's study just yesterday, and I decided to look in Burkhoff's Systematic Theology to see if he says anything on the subject. It's a 750-page book about the truth, Christian truth, truth of the Bible. It gives one sentence to the intercessory work of Christ. David Clarkston, who, by the way, Clarkson, who did some work on the subject, began by saying this: it, the subject of the intercessory work of Christ, is of great consequence, though not much that I can find insisted upon. So he had the same problem that I did. John Murray, in his grand work, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, which I would advise for everyone to have, to read, and to master in their lifetime, this great and grand work on the gospel, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, intercession is given only passive notice. So even the best of the best don't seem to give it the attention that it would appear to deserve. Secondly, it's a lacuna. The word lacuna means a missing place, a space, a blank. In hymnody, the hymns that we sing, do you know any hymns which are squarely based on the subject of the intercessory work of Christ? I know of one. It's found in the Gadsby Hymnal, hymn numbered 117 in the Gadsby. And whether you're familiar with that hymnal or not, most aren't. There's only one stanza of one verse that really stands out in the Trinity hymn. And I'll indicate what that is as we go along. So it's not sung by the people of God and in the praises of God, which is a problem. Thirdly, it is mentioned in the confession, the London Confession of Faith or the Westminster. It's mentioned three times only. Two of them are in the usual place and where you'd expect it, in chapter 8, which is entitled Of Christ the Mediator. And I would say that in the three times that it's mentioned, I have stated here, they are unnuanced references to the intercessory work of Christ. By unnuanced, what I mean is it's mentioned, but we're not told anything by way of exposition about it. Chapter 8, paragraph 4, He, Christ, also ascended into heaven, and there sits at the right hand of the Father, making intercession. But that's all it tells us. No details, no exposition. In the same chapter, paragraph 8, it says, He, that is Christ, doth certainly and effectually apply and communicate the same, that is eternal redemption, making intercession for them. But it's unnuanced. No information except the mention of intercession. It's found one other time, in chapter 17, which chapter is entitled, Of Perseverance. And in the second paragraph it says, This perseverance depends upon the efficacy of the merit and intercession of Jesus Christ. Now that's good to know, but that's all it says. No help. So it's poorly attested in print. It is a missing space in Christian hymnody. It's unnuanced in the three times it's found in the confession. And fourthly, we need to note its experimental neglect. That is, if we know very little about it, it's very difficult for us to improve it or to benefit from it. It is the most impoverished and unimproved entry in the gospel glossary. All those terms, the technical terms that end in T-I-O-N or I-O-N, it's the least improved and the most impoverished of these great truths of the person and work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So we ought to overturn that, I think. And that, of course, is the interest of these studies this evening and twice on tomorrow. Now then, when we come to the Bible and we want to learn all that we can about the doctrine of intercession, we will find two things. First of all, it is a large subject. And secondly, it's a very small subject. Depends on how you look at it. On the one hand, it's a large subject if we take it generally in terms of Christ's whole mediatorial office. All of Christ's activity may broadly be labeled intercession. The living, the dying, and the living again of the Lord Jesus Christ. All of His active obedience, all of His passive obedience, can in a large and broad way be labeled intercession. All of Christ's work, ultimately, is an interpositioning of Himself on our behalf. So in that sense, We could be here for 300 sessions instead of just three if we were to exhaust all of that. Everything that Christ did ultimately can be called intercession, His interpositioning of Himself on our behalf. In fact, Hugh Martin, who has written on this subject quite helpfully, says, "The most general conception we can form of intercession is that it is an intervention or an interposition of Christ of Himself." If we take, again, John Murray's book, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, that's a brilliant title. Redemption Accomplished and Applied. So we have all of the parts of the gospel glossary, which would be the accomplishment of Christ, and all of the application of His accomplishment. Murray deals with all these things. What is it that bridges the gap between redemption accomplished and redemption applied? It's the doctrine, one doctrine. It's the doctrine of intercession. It leaps the gulf between the two and establishes the link between redemption accomplished and redemption applied. So if we take it in its largest possible way, it would be impossible for us to even introduce the subject. However, it is also a small subject. That is, if we take it narrowly, of as one aspect of Christ's sessional business. That is, technically, His business as seated at the right hand of the Father. He may do many things. He may have many hats to wear, as we say it commonly nowadays. This study refers to but one of those activities at the right hand of the Father. And in that sense, it's a narrow subject rather than a large one. And that narrow part of the subject is the focus of our study in these times together. All right, a definition. And always need to start with a definition. What on earth are we talking about? Well, we have this word intercession. It's a part of your vocabulary. You probably have used it. It's not something that sounds foreign to you. It's not a term which is so technical that it requires a great deal of explanation. It's a Latin word. The word intercession is the Latin word intercedere. And it's composed as a compound word of two parts. Inter, and you know what inter means. We speak of international affairs, that is, affairs between nations, interpersonal relationships, the relationship between persons, inter, and the Latin verb sedere, intercedere, intercede. Sedere is a Latin verb which means to go between. Very simple, and you knew that's what it meant already, didn't you? The Greek word that's translated intercession in the New Testament is a verb which means to meet or to fall in with, whether positively or negatively. We also have another word that's very much akin to it, the word mediator, that which comes between and intercedes. I've always been fascinated by the study of subatomic physics. How boring is this guy, all right? And I always have laughed at the attempts of subatomic physicists to name the particles that they discover as they break the atom further and further into its constituent elements. And so they call some particles charms and others they call quarks because the fellow that was thinking about it heard the seagulls outside. That's really where the name quark came from. He thought it sounded like them going quark, quark, quark. And that's why we have quarks, charms, and then the other ones that are more common. There's one that they mention quite commonly nowadays called a meson. And they call it a meson because it is a particle which glues together. They've got another one called a gluon. But a meson is a particle, a particle in the nucleus of an atom which holds together the other particles. All right. And the word mediator is built on the Greek word mesos, which meson comes from, that which holds or glues things together. Here's something of the idea of intercession. There's a Hebrew word which is found in Isaiah 53, which is also a word which, if we were to pursue that, we would find that the Hebrews had a word for this same idea. Now then, The idea of to intercede means basically this, as we digest those words and look at the places it's found in the Bible. It means to make the interest of another one's own, and thus to intercede on their behalf. Originally, it was a legal term borrowed from the courts of judicature. The actions of a proxy answering objections brought by a plaintiff against a defendant. So the one who would stand as a proxy, an advocate, and answer objections brought against his client. He would stand interposed between the accuser and his client and raise a defense on their behalf. This is what it is to intercede. Now then, let me give you a couple of written out definitions, and I borrowed them from the most trusted sources. The first person who's always good for a definition is John Owen, the Puritan. Here's what he said about intercession. Christ's intercession is an appearing for us in heaven in the presence of God, a demonstration of his body, wherein for us he suffered, by the presentation of himself with the blood of the covenant before the throne of grace in our behalf. And herein his intercession consists, being nothing as it were, but his oblation, which means sacrifice, continued. Right, now that's a good definition. I don't expect you to have memorized it, but we might come back to it again. Here's what John Murray says. The heavenly high priesthood of Christ means that Christ appears in the presence of God to plead on the basis of what he has accomplished, the fulfillment of all the promises, the bestowment of all the benefits, and the endowment of all the graces secured and ratified by his own offering. Or Hugh Martin in his book on the atonement. His acknowledgement of his representative relationship, his unflinching resolution to abide by it, his forth-putting of priestly energy, his delight in the everlasting covenant, his loyal recognition of the law, every active principle that was at work in his sacrifice, in a word, this, in the essence of it, is the intercession. Now, let's come to see what the Bible has to say. Where would we turn to find some material, biblical material, on the subject of intercession? Now again, this can be a large subject or a small subject. And when we narrow it down to the subject that we have in mind, there are only four texts in all the Bible that directly bear upon this particular doctrine. Now there's a lot of others which bear upon it in an ancillary way. But there are only four that you could use as a kind of text and say, there it is. The Bible is talking about this subject particularly. There are only four. And since there are only four, let's look at them. All right, take your Bibles. First is found in Isaiah and chapter 53. Now I can assume that Isaiah 53 is well known to you. But the very last statement in Isaiah 53 is this, Isaiah 53 and verse 12. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. I want you to remember that text, especially that last phrase. He bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Now, the rest of them are in the New Testament. The first I would have you to note is in Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, verse 34. where Paul says, "Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather, that was raised from the dead, who is at the right hand of the God, who also makes intercession for us." Now, those two texts are very much alike, the one in Isaiah and now the one in Romans, because they both mention that Christ's work was twofold, that he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Here, who is he that condemns? It is Christ that died, and it is Christ that makes intercession for us. Now, the third place I would have you to look, and the fourth, are both in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews, first of all, chapter 7. Hebrews 7 and verse 25. We break into the whole argument of the book of Hebrews, this statement we find, 7:25. "Wherefore also he is able to save to the uttermost them that draw near unto God through him, seeing he ever lives, make intercession for them." And the last is an important text, but it does not even use the word intercession. So if you did a concordant study and said, "I want to see every place in the Bible where the word intercession is used," you wouldn't even find this one. It's Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 24. Hebrews 9 and verse 24. "For Christ entered not into a holy place made with hands, in pattern to the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear before the face of God for us." You notice that the word intercession is not even found there, but it is a text which deals with our subject. Now, one word of clarification. There are other kinds of intercession. There are other ways in which the word intercession applies, which are not part of our study. For instance, it says in Romans chapter 8 that the Spirit makes intercession for us. We don't know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit helps us. He makes intercession for us. We're not talking about that. That's not this subject. We're also not talking about that intercession which is common to believers. Paul says, I exhort that prayers and supplications and everything and intercession be made for all men, for kings and those who are in authority. Remember 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1. That's a kind of intercession. That's true, but it's not a text which is dealing with our part of the study. We're dealing with the intercessory work of Christ, not of the Spirit, not of common believers, but of Christ seated at the right hand of the Father. Now then, there's a certain terminology which broadens out our subject. That is used to speak of Christ's interpositioning of himself on our behalf, in the New Testament in particular. His interpositioning of himself, and in fact, not only is he standing between us and that which could oppose us, but he also surrounds us. In fact, there are four words, and I'd like you to think about these. The first one is mediator. The second one is advocate. The third is forerunner. And the fourth is surety. You run across those words? They're not unfamiliar to you. What's interesting about these four words, they all bespeak the intercessory work of Christ. What's interesting about them is the word that is behind them in the original language of the New Testament. The word mediator I've already spoken about comes from the Greek word mesos, which means between. The word advocate, where in 1 John chapter 2, we have an advocate with the Father. If any man sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous, literally means the one who stands beside. All right? Mediator, one who stands between. Advocate, one who stands beside. Then there's the word forerunner. It's used in Hebrews chapter 6, for instance, and verse 20, where we read, "Whither as a forerunner Jesus entered in for us, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. If he's a mediator, he stands between. An advocate stands beside. A forerunner stands before. And then there's a surety. An enguos is the Greek term. Literally, it has the idea of one who is nearby or one who stands behind us. Now, if these four words mean Christ stands between, beside, before, and behind us, it's almost as if the authors of the New Testament said, I want you to see that you're surrounded by one who has interpositioned himself on your behalf. This is what intercession is all about. Now, in order for us to understand this, realize that if we have these three studies, the first study is nuts and bolts introduction. And that tends to be perhaps musty and dusty, and I trust not boring. The heart of the matter will be tomorrow morning, and then the application of the whole matter will reserve for tomorrow evening. So you need to endure this to get to that, all right? There's a certain background to the intercessory work of Christ that we need to explore. And it has to do with the Old Testament and the office of a priest. It's very difficult to do, but if we could put ourselves back into the Old Testament and think about what it was like to be a worshiper of Jehovah in the Old Testament. The logistics of approach to God was extraordinarily difficult in the Old Testament. You had to have the appropriate sacrifice. You had to bring it to the priest. The priest would lay his hand upon the head, signify the identification of the sinner with the sacrifice. It would have to be sacrificed in a certain way, depending on what kind of sacrifice it was. His blood would have to be shed. The animal would have to be divided. Parts went here and parts went there. And the blood was to be taken in a certain way and presented to God. Once a year, he was to go into the Holy of Holy Place, and only once a year, not without blood. All this stuff had to be done. It was a great piece of, it was a logistical nightmare to get into the presence of God once in a year. In fact, here's what one man has said, Donald McLeod. He says, it is fair to say that right through the Old Testament, it was a terrible strain to be an Israelite. The divine visitor was not easy to live with. And the protocol required by his presence was exceedingly burdensome. At almost every point, life was hedged in with what could easily be regarded as irksome restrictions. You couldn't go marching into the presence of God. It was all this bloodletting. What an amazing slaughterhouse it was, the sacrifices that were continually offered, and all the priestly activity, the taking down and setting up of the tabernacle, all of the stuff that was involved. Aren't you glad you're in the New Testament? Because God wanted to impress upon the Israelites that there was this tension about getting into the presence of God, it wasn't easy. And so there was the necessity of what the French called a denouement, or the unraveling of a plot. How do sinful men get into the presence of a holy God? And it was hard work in the Old Testament. There were layers upon layers of protocol to get a man in there on behalf of the people once a year. Why? Why was it such a trouble? What was God showing them with all of this burdensome protocol? Two things. There was an offended party, and there was an offending party. The offended party was God, and the offending party was me. And it wasn't easy to get as an offending party into the presence of an offended God. And so there was all of this burdensome protocol. There was offense given by us, and it was taken by God. So you couldn't just waltz into his presence. There needed to be all of this stuff taken care of. Do you remember when Adam sinned? God kicked him out of the garden because sinners are no longer trustworthy. He told him not to eat of that tree, right? He realized you can't trust this guy. So he kicked him out of the garden because he couldn't trust him not to continue to eat of the tree of life and live forever. He needed to die now because he'd sinned. So God put an angel there with a sword which pointed in four directions. Now that doesn't mean there's no way back into the presence of God. But what it does mean, if you come back into the presence of God, you've got to deal with the flaming sword. How do you do it? How do you do it? Picture in the Old Testament the ark. Remember the ark? It was there in the Holy of Holies. It was a box made out of acacia wood. It was so many cubits wide and so many cubits high, and it was overlaid with gold. And inside of it, the book of Hebrews tells us, were three things. Do you remember what they are? Well, the Ten Commandments was placed in there. There was also Aaron's rod that budded, and there was a pot of manna. Remember that? Could you have answered that on a trivia question? Aaron's rod that budded, a pot of manna, and the Ten Commandments. And then above the ark were these representative creatures, which we know from the Bible, were set there to represent the holiness of God. Now, what do you have inside the ark? You have the Ten Commandments. What can you say about the Ten Commandments? We have broken them. Why a pot of manna? Because it represented the complaining of the people of God against God's provision, right? We hate this. Our souls loathe this light bread. Remember? Let's go back to Egypt where they had the leeks and the onions. And Aaron's rod that budded, why did Aaron's rod bud? It was because of the rebellion of the people of God against God's instituted authority. Remember that? The gainsaying of Arnoldus. All right. So inside the ark, what do you have? Those things which depict and represent and put into bold relief man's sinfulness. What do you have on top of the ark? Those creatures which symbolically represented the holiness of God. What do you have if you have man's sinfulness below and God's holiness above? You've got a problem. What was it that solved the problem? Between the two, there was what was called the mercy seat, or the propitiatory, where blood was placed. So the offended party and the offending party could once again meet. So there was this tension. And that's why all of this stuff had to be done in the Old Testament. God wanted them to see the tension that was. How do sinful men come into the presence of God? And so God instituted that there should be a priest. Man cannot come into the presence of God without a priest. And the priest had a twofold function. And remember Isaiah 53? Remember Romans chapter 8? What is the twofold function of a priest? He must bear the sin of many and make intercession for the transgressors. That's what a priest does. Two things only. He has to offer up an acceptable sacrifice, and he has to present that sacrifice in the presence of God, interpositioned between the offending party and the offended God in order for there to be made peace. So the priest had this twofold function. Who is he that condemns? Condemns? It's Christ that died, yea, that makes intercession for us. As Hugh Martin has said, the great propitiatory offering is riveted to the throne of God on high. Every active principle that was in operation in Emmanuel's soul on the cross passes over without a break and blends into the permanent function of intercession. This is the twofold function of the priest. Now, the fire to burn the incense, which seems to be symbolic, the incense which goes up and speaks of the intercessory work of Christ, the fire of the incense was lighted, the fire was taken from the brazen altar in the Old Testament. So this was all symbolically laid out. Where do you get the intercessory incense? You get it from the altar of sacrifice. The twofold office of a priest. You see, it's all riveted, as Hugh Martin said, and connected together. Interestingly enough, when you come to Hebrews chapter 9, the author of Hebrews, whomever it may have been, he gives us the furniture and the setting of the Old Testament temple or the tabernacle. But he makes apparently a mistake. You know what it is? He puts the altar of incense, which was not in the Holy of Holies, he puts it in the Holy of Holies. Did you ever notice that? And there are a lot of people who have scratched their head about that and say, the altar of Hebrews made a mistake. We Old Testament scholars know that the altar of incense was not in the Holy of Holies. But the author of Hebrews in the New Testament says, now it's there. Why? Because the priest has done his work. Intercession and the sacrifice have been brought together, fulfilled and accomplished in one who is our intercessor. So then, what is the duty of a high priest? Simply stated, it's this. The duty of a high priest is to manage the affairs of the people of God so as to bring them into the presence of God safely. It's no problem to come into the presence of God. All of us will stand in the presence of God. We need no specific credentials. Every one of us here tonight, one day, will stand in the presence of God. The duty of a priest is to bring sinful men into the presence of God. There's a very important word that goes in that sentence. Safely. You can say, I can get a lot of places, but I can't get there safely. How do we get into the presence of God safely? We have to have a priest. There must be a mediator. There must be the work of intercession. Spurgeon once says, we have before us this massive pillar upon which the Christian hope rests. Though the whole world should press on it, it would never break or bend. It has to be that good, because this priest has to get us into the presence of God safely. Now then, let's do another thing by way of introduction and setting the stage. And that is the sacrifice of Christ and all that it involved, all of his active and passive obedience here on earth. How do we distinguish it? How can it be distinguished from his intercessory? And I want to give you six ways in which it is not distinguished, and then two ways that it is. First of all, they're not different in that they are both equally the work of Christ and Christ alone. There is no other priest, and there is no other intercessor. Now, we'll come back to that because that's important. There is no other mediator between God and man, Paul tells Timothy, except the man Christ Jesus. John Flavel says it is the peculiar and incommunicable prerogative of Jesus Christ alone. So both the sacrificial work or his oblation and his intercession are the work of Christ and Christ alone. Secondly, they're both sacerdotal functions. Now the word sacerdotal is just a fancy word. It means a priest. They're both priestly activities to bear the sin of many and make intercession for the transgressors. They are both priestly functions. Thirdly, they're both covenant transactions. They're the work of Christ according to a covenant between himself and his Father on our behalf. More of that later. Fourthly, they're both forensic business. By forensic, I mean legal business. Christ answering all that the law required of us. The law demanded of us a precept. And because we broke the precept, it demands of us a penalty. And so the work of Christ as intercessor, he must be able to plead both the precept fulfilled on our behalf and the penalty endured on our behalf. And Christ does that. Both the oblation of Christ and the intercession of Christ are covenantal transactions. They're forensic business. Fifthly, they both embrace the same objects. Those for whom he offered himself as an oblation are exactly those, not one more and not one less, for whom he also stands as our intercessor. And sixthly, they both propose the same end, which is what? To bring the people of God into the presence of God safely. So oblation, or the sacrifice of Christ, and the intercession of Christ are not distinguishable in these six ways. They're both the work of Christ, both sacerdotal functions, both covenantal transactions, both forensic business, both embrace the same objects, and both propose the same end. To wit, as John Owen says, to bring many sons to glory. Now then, having said that, how are they different? They're different in two ways. Number one, whereas oblation, or the sacrifice of Christ, was accomplished on earth, intercession is accomplished in heaven. All that Christ did on earth was just that. It was here. On our behalf, He bare the sin of men. But the intercessory work of Christ is not done here. It's done, as we read in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 24, Christ entered not into a holy place made with hands, but into heaven to appear before the face of God for us. The oblation of Christ is accomplished on earth. The intercession is accomplished in heaven. Thomas Goodwin has said that Christ had not been a high priest if He had not gone to heaven and priested it there too. Christ has as much work still in heaven as ever, though of another kind. That's not denying the finished work of Christ, but there's a sense in which it wasn't finished. What Christ did on earth was His oblation. What He does for us in the presence of God, we call His intercession. Now, the second way in which they're different is this. Whereas oblation has been finished, intercession never will be. Now think about this, and I wonder if it's ever dawned on you before. Our security will always and forever depend upon the continued intercessory work of Christ. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25. He ever lives. It is the end of His being and the business of His life to make intercession for us. His oblation has been finished. His intercession never will be. Hebrews 12 and verse 2, He is the author of our faith. That's His oblation. He is also the finisher of our faith. And that is His continual and eternal intercession. Listen to the words of Thomas Goodwin, who was a Puritan, by the way. I went to Bunhill Fields in London. And right next door to John Owen's grave is Thomas Goodwin. I'd like him to be buried right between them. Here's what Thomas Goodwin said. By His death, He did but begin the execution of His office. In heaven, He ends it. We are to look upon our Mediator as doing as much work for us in heaven at this instant as He ever did here on earth. All His work was not done when He was done here. That work here was indeed the harder piece of the two, yet soon dispatched. But His work in heaven, though sweeter far, lies in His hands forever. Or John Murray says, the process of redemption is not yet consummated, and because so, the arrangements of that economy are still in operation. It is a patent fact written in the boldest fashion on the New Testament witness that the mediation of Christ is not suspended and the intercession is but one concrete aspect of that mediation. Or as Thomas Watson, another Puritan, he's always able to put things in very small little sentences. He says, when Christ was done dying, He was not done praying. Now, in conclusion, let's consider this. And again, it's a conclusion which merely leads us to the study tomorrow morning. So we're just setting ourselves up and preparing ourselves to continue. I want you to note that neither Christ's incarnation, death, or resurrection accomplished anything per se. Now that might be a startling statement. And if I left it just alone, you might say, you know, that man is off-center. In fact, he may be so far off-center that this doesn't sound even true to me. Neither Christ's incarnation, death, or resurrection accomplished anything by itself. As a matter of fact, let me just suggest this to your thinking. Everything that Christ did or ever will do was nothing unless two things are true. There must be two features present. Number one, there must be a covenant. He must have done it because his father sent him to do it. Otherwise, it was just stuff. And secondly, it has to be pleaded in the presence of God. There must be a covenant beneath it, and there must be an intercession beyond it, or else it accomplished nothing at all. Look at it this way. You say that there was 2,000 years ago a man who was born. So what? You say 2,000 years ago there was a man that lived and taught, had a lot of ideas. So what? There's a man that lived 2,000 years ago and died. Of course he did. All right? None of those things are particularly striking, are they? Do you realize that's what our Savior did? He was born, he lived, and he died. What if you said a little more? Not only was he born, but he was born in a way that no man has ever been born before. A virgin birth. You might say, well, that's striking. But so what? You say, well, but he lived a life and never once violated the law of God. And in his active obedience, he wrought out a perfect demonstration of legal righteousness. You say, well, that's remarkable. And I've never seen that happen. But if you tell me that some man did that a long time ago, that's a strange and remarkable thing to say. Well, not only that, he didn't just die. He said that he died on behalf of a people whom his father had given him. He died for them. He gave his life for them. Well, that's remarkable. Scarcely a man would ever do that. And yet he did. All right, I'm impressed. All of those things impressed me. What if you went even further and said, not only did he die, he rose from the dead. Wow, that's striking. That's remarkable, you might say. But I submit to you this evening, if a man was born of a virgin, lived a perfect life, died on behalf of other people, and rose from the dead, it wouldn't save you. Not without intercession. That work, as remarkable as it may be, you might say, was his work remarkable? Yes. Was it moving? Perhaps. Was it saving? No. Not by itself. Not unless the merit of all of that was pled before the Father and because it was fulfilled on behalf of the covenant. This is to say that without a covenant, he would have had no warrant to proceed. Without his incarnation and death, he would have nothing to plead. Without his intercession and session, he would have no audience. He must go into the presence of God. And without his intercession, he would have nothing to show for his obedience. He wouldn't have saved a person if he'd have lived, died, and even lived again, unless he had come into the presence of the Father and pled the merit of his blood. We're saved, ultimately, by none of those things. We're saved by the fact that Christ pleads all those things in the presence of the Father. And that's what intercession is. So I would like you to think about it most seriously. Let us not allow it to remain the most unimproved entry in the gospel glossary. John Murray said this. If you think I'm a little off base, John Murray said, outside of intercession, we must say, there is no salvation. John Flavel said, had he not done this for us in heaven, all his work on earth had signified nothing. Now, I almost thought to do this, and I could have done it. I said that there were no hymns that were given over to this great doctrine of intercession. I did find one in the Gadsby, but there is another. It's the hymn numbered 393 in the Old Trinity Hymnal. You know the one, let not conscience make you linger, nor of fitness fondly dream. All the fitness he requires is to feel your need of him. This he gives you, this he gives you, 'tis the Spirit's rising beam. You know, all the verses to that, if I could think of it right now, I'd quote them all for you. It's a great hymn. I love it. It's by Joseph Hart. Verse 4 says this, Lo, the incarnate God ascended, pleads the merit of His blood. Venture on Him, venture wholly. Let no other trust in truth. None but Jesus can do helpless sinners good. Now I could take that verse, that fourth stanza, and I could have taken each part of that verse and made a part of this study. Lo, the incarnate God ascended, pleads the merit of His blood. Venture on Him, venture wholly. Let no other trust in truth. And I think you'll find that everything that we need to say and will say is found in one of those words or phrases in that hymn. It's really classic. It's the best statement that I can think of in that hymn by Joseph Hart. Now then, let's leave it there. Our time is at least gone. And say that this evening what we've done is set the scene. How can sinners such as ourselves get into the presence of God safely? And the answer is, Christ has ascended to the right hand of the Father, and He appears there on our behalf and pleads the merit of His blood. Had He not done that, everything else that He did would have saved no one. And so if we would exalt the name of the Lord Jesus Christ in these days of study together, it will be because we've come to appreciate the fact that without intercession, there is no salvation. You don't think about it very much, but Christ is there now, pleading the merit of His blood. Your name may not be mentioned on any particular honor roll in this world. Think about it. If you be the people of God, your name is mentioned before the Father by the Lord Jesus Christ, the incarnate God ascended, pleads the merit of His blood. When He was done dying, He was not done praying. And He prays on behalf of His people. And that's how the people of God get into the presence of God safely. All right? That's just the beginning. All right? And so I hope that you at least have whetted your appetite enough to where you'll come back. And we'll try to continue this, God willing, tomorrow morning. Thank you very much for your patience and for your attention.